And we are live. Welcome to the Listen to This Bull live show. My name is Matthew Mulholland. Remington is about to pop on here so that he could join us as well. But for whatever reason, it looks like he's having a little bit of issues. And it is giving me some problems with Instagram suddenly too. So, crap. This is the problem with live shows. Bear with me, everybody that's actually watching this. One of the benefits of watching this live is you get to see all the ways in which everything goes wrong for Matt over and over again. It's just not going to do it. We're not going to go live on Instagram today, as it turns out. That's fine. So one of the benefits of watching this live is you get to ask questions live. I've got I've got John Pruitt with Addison Riley waiting in the wings right now. John Pruitt and I have had lots of discussions over the years about his work as an expert and how it is that he's able to do expert work on both sides. And so I'm going to bring him in just a minute, and we're going to talk about what it's like to work both sides, how it is you can gain the respect of both sides by doing the right job and not being full of shit, basically. And all the things that come with that. And you guys get to drive the questions. So if you have a question that you want to answer to, we will bring that up on the screen and we will answer your questions live. So, hey, good news. You're here live. You get to watch all this happen. All I have to do to start the show is push this button. So one of these days, John, I'm going to get myself one of those voiceover intros so it's not me just making it up out of my ass every single time as we go, because they're always terrible, terrible intros.
I think it's better than anything I could do, because what you can do with tech is nothing I can do, trust me, I guarantee it. If I didn't have Chris, my director in my life, I probably couldn't walk and chew gum, to be honest with you. So congratulations.
If you wear a helmet or a hat that acts as one while chewing the gum and walking, it helps out quite a bit.
That's what I do at conferences. I just take the helmet off right before I speak.
Yeah, that will work. So we've talked many times and briefly and sometimes over a beer and sometimes not at different things. And a lot of it is just me trying to find out how it is that you were able to get in with, there's Remington. I'll give him a second to get on before he get himself situated. I'm sure he needs a beer still. Nope, he's got it. Here we go. Remington. And then I can do this. Perfect. Hey, man. So how did you end up getting your first work from insurance companies? Or were you working for them to begin with? What's the deal? How did it go down?
It's a really interesting story. It's a story I'm quite proud of. I know you've heard my story. You know, I do motivational speaking all over the country for all industries. And I've been very blessed. The story, long and short, to tell you the truth, is, you know, I had a bad business partner. And let me preface it by saying I didn't have a bad business partner. It's my fault. I have to take full responsibility for the situations I've been in my life. And I had a business partner who wasn't the most gracious of individuals, who messed up a lot of houses. And in that company that we were in, we were doing everything we could to salvage it. I spent $400,000 of my own money fixing people's houses that he messed up. So we started in construction defect, fixing our own properties. And people who were suing us after he left the company, we were trying to hold things together, started using us for construction defect cases against other contractors, if you will, because those guys ran away. Whereas I look people in the eye and said, look, I don't even know what's going on with your project, but come hell or high water, I'm going to fix it. And we did. And some cases we let people out of the contracts and we parted in mutual ways. And, you know, the people who were suing us started hiring us to help out other people. Now I'm retained on over 400 criminal cases for construction fraud. And some of the people that were defending our general liability policy did insurance work. and they knew I wasn't the person people were trying to say I was, and they started using me for insurance stuff. And I've been a contractor doing insurance restoration for a long time, 20 years now, I guess, 19 years. And I didn't know any, I public adjuster, IA, whatever. I always said, oh, maybe I could be an adjuster one day if I really wanted to, if construction didn't work out or roofing didn't work out or engineering. But, you know, it just, it panned out to where I just came in and started writing litigation. I wrote, they were like, hey, we just need an estimate. I used to never write an Xactimate.
So wait a minute though. Hang on. So your advice for someone that wants to get into expert work would then be to get sued and then come out the other end, not having lost probably.
You know, I will say this, that we all go through trials and tribulations in our lives.
Right.
And how we deal with those trials and tribulations is going to direct us down a path. And if we're rowing in the right direction of integrity and character, you will find land. You will find that end of that stream. And as long as you do it the right way, people will be there cheering you on. And the people who aren't cheering you on won't be there anymore. And it's amazing the life you can have. You want to be an expert? You learn to be neutral for both sides. You learn to tell the truth. And always understand you're there for the case. You're not there for one side or the other. The damages don't change based on who retains you. Only the truth. That's how you become an expert, in all honesty.
This is proof that John actually does have a good reputation with the carriers. Steve Badger is watching the show right now from Mexico. All right. Hey, Steve. He's been on the show a few times as well. And actually, I probably need to reach out to him to get back on for some of the stuff that he's talking about on LinkedIn at the moment. But hey.
Well, he's listening. We could talk crap about him.
I mean, he said his connection sucks. So maybe we can do that and it won't matter so much.
Now, I'll tell you what, that's one genuine guy right there. I have always enjoyed talking to him. He's always taking my calls, taking my emails. I think he's a blessing to the industry, in all honesty. And I think a lot of people need to get off their high horse and understand that there's people on both sides of this fence that want the good in this industry, because nobody wants what's going on to continue. We got to find some common ground.
Remington, are you muted or something? I can't hear you at all. That would actually explain why you haven't said hi. You know, what John just said is proof, nothing, Remington, is exactly the kind of thing that you should say if you want to gain the respect of somebody from the other side. Did you see how expertly he talked well about Stephen Badger?
After I bashed him.
After he bashed him a little
after
bit.
After I bashed him.
John is one of those guys, and I hope everybody's paying attention to this, where he can find common ground with anyone. And when you're negotiating with anybody, whether you're just acting as a PA or something, and there's a carrier side of that, Remington, I'll just let you know when it starts working. How about that? No. Bloody hell. You got to turn your recorder on, which has a power button on the side of it. That's the thing that the mic is turned into. Oh, it's on. Okay. Then you have to hit your settings and pick which source it's coming from, and you just need your mic. I'll let you know when it's working. You just keep testing out, buddy. I love going live. Audio and video technical issues are great. You know, all of these podcasters out there, I'm going to throw a little shade. All of you that are getting everything recorded and then cleaned up and then edited down and all that extra work you're doing, man, be real, be authentic. Let the problems occur. And then we'll see if you're any good at your job. Anyway.
It's just like that on a deposition nowadays.
Yeah.
Hello. Hello.
There he is. There you are.
Am I good?
Got you now. Yeah. Yeah. Finally. All right.
Hey, so, I want to say two things. Number one is Matt came over like 2 weeks ago and helped me set this up. So it's all on him.
My fault.
Because of the technical stuff. Hey, it's the beauty of going live, man. If things happen, you know? So it is what it is versus just cutting a bunch of stuff up. That's why I like what we do. Secondly, I'm going to put Steven's message up one more time and want to say we forgot the best part of this whole two sentences here, three sentences. And that is, he's having a drink with us. So I appreciate he's having a margarita with us. Cheers, Steven. And
first time I've had a drink
that's important. That's important.
Yeah. Now, I've always gotten along with Stephen Badger. There's a lot of things that we agree on. There's some things that we disagree on that really it's a matter of perspective. There's a few things that I think are egregious that we disagree on, but it's a minute amount. And we're both doing our jobs. So you can almost understand from a perspective, if you put it in that regard, that somebody's doing their job. And that's the thing that we deal with on a regular basis with the carriers. We're dealing with people that are doing their job. And if you can put yourself in their shoes for a second, then you can relate with them on just about anything, and you can get along with them, and you can do your job and they can do their job, and you can gain their respect and have mutual respect amongst them.
Oh, so Matt, you hit the nail on the head. Even though you spell your name incorrectly, I will agree with you on this. You know, you're so right. And I tell these people all the time, and it, the first thing I do for my construction company when I call into an insurance company, even if they're very difficult, is the first thing I do is I understand that these people are literally people. So let's think about that first, okay? They're doing a job. And sometimes what they're doing in their job is not, it's out of their control, right? Whether it's their authority, whether it's a guideline, whatever it is. But to be honest with you, it's on both sides of the fence. But the first thing that I do when I talk to them is I always try to kill whatever, you know, I'm the 300th person they've talked to that day. If they want to talk about their dog for an hour, you better believe I'm going to talk about their dog for an hour. I'm going to ask them, how's your day going? Has anybody been yelling at you today? And then they laugh. And then let me tell you about this guy I just got off on the phone with. You know, what are you going to do? You're having a hard time getting a hold of him. So you're going to tell him you're going to name him in a CRN. You're going to sue him personally. You're going to take the firstborn child. Where do you think your file is going to go? Right to the bottom. And then you're going to complain that they don't get back in touch with you. And you're going to say, oh, well, I've emailed them 6-7 times. Oh, I'm sorry. You emailed them. How about you try picking up that phone and actually scheduling a call instead of saying they're not answering my calls? It always goes to voicemail. Have you tried to set a time? Because I'm going to tell you right now, I have been successful setting a time. You call me, I'm not going to answer. There's no way. I'm on a roof. I'm on a plane. I'm on whatever it is. But there's a way of going about things instead of trashing people. If you know, I did over 100 Hurricane Sally cases after Hurricane Sally, 100 roofing and construction cases. How many lawsuits did I file?
You?
Me. Zero. Zero. Wow. AOBs. Zero. If I can do it, I know you can all do it. But you have to understand, this is a psychology game. This is not, let's go running of the bulls and just see who the last man standing is all the way through a 60-day CRN to let it expire so we can make sure we tee up our bad faith that nobody really gets very often. Although I can tell you how to get it. I understand. I get that part. But if we don't fix the psychology in our industry to understand that we treat people how they want to be treated and not how we want to be treated, we're never going to get anywhere. Now, what needs to happen in our continuing education of adjusters, I'm an adjuster. You're an attorney, you're an adjuster. We should have psychology. We have mandatory ethics. It's boring. I know, I teach it. We should have construction. Why in the world do adjusters not have construction in their continuing ed? Because I can tell you right now, nobody knows which end of the hammer to hold.
It doesn't make sense. You're right. It doesn't go into their license necessarily, but if they're going to write estimates for a scope of work, then they should have some kind of construction background at least. And they used to. I mean, that was the source that most carriers would pull from when trying to hire someone new. Not so much anymore. Now it's Burger King.
When I was at Napia, I got up and I spoke and I said, we have a competence issue in our industry. For instance, if Remington gets a file, say somebody's been beaten down, they're just tired of it. They can't handle the grind anymore. Mr. and Mrs. Smith have just had it. They think you're a really bad PA. They think you're a bad contractor. So you got to take it to the attorney and you got to take it the distance. If that file is DOA because you didn't submit it or the attorney didn't recognize it, it doesn't have ACV value. Well, congratulations. You just basically lost your case. You know, all these different things that I see of these files that go in there. Why are we throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks for negotiation reasons? all of these little death by a thousand paper cut deals that you're doing is making the other side say, this estimate's bull crap. I'm not going to talk to this guy. I'm done. I'm done talking to him. But if you can sit down with the adjuster and say, hey, could you just schedule me 15 minutes? I'll go through it all, make sure I'm prepared for you. And then you go and say, let's go line by line. What do you have an issue with? Let's just look at it. It's, well, Mr. Pruitt, it's not the line items. It's the whole thing.
Yeah, it's great. The full dollar amount. It seems unreasonable. It's the full dollar. Now, you could go line by line, and you could prove every single one of them, and he would end up having to agree with it. But the full dollar amount might be excessive in relation to the kind of bids that someone might normally get from a cash price kind of deal. Now, that premise, though, I want you to be aware that probably about 50 to 60% of our audience do mostly like residential storm claims. So if you were to have like State Farm on a file or something and you tried to ask them to spend 15 minutes with you to go over the file, probably not going to happen, right? Probably not going to happen at most of the big box carriers on residential claims. But on large loss, they don't have so many files. They definitely need to do that kind of thing because that's the only way to get it off their desk anyway. And that's a very good way to go about doing things.
Well, let me ask you this, Matt. To that point, how many of you out there listening to this are trying that? Let's start. Let's not bark at somebody else's porch because it's dirty. Let's talk about our porch. I know there's a lot of people out there teaching public adjusters how to do their thing. That's cool. I was never a public adjuster. I only got an insurance adjuster license because I do so much expert work and I did so much coverage talk. It made sense to have it for a credential. I come from the contractor standpoint. Let's talk sticks and bricks because I shouldn't be having a coverage issue with you anyway, because why in the world am I taking a case as a coverage issue?
Hey, Remington, when talking to an expert or trying to qualify someone as an expert, does credentials or experience matter more, you think?
You ask 10 different attorneys, you're going to get 10, you're going to get a 50-50 split on this. I want to say this first. You got to shoot to score. So I agree with what John is saying about getting on the phone with an adjuster for 15 minutes and trying to work something out. That's the way to try, right? Even if it's let's just say it's a little slice of the pie. Let's say it's 25% of your claims get worked out that way and the adjuster will get on the phone. That's still 25% of homeowners that are taken care of. I like that approach. I just want to say that because I do that with attorneys. So I get on the phone with them. I hash it out, see if we can get something worked out. Secondly, I'm all about somebody having experience over credentials. You can have all the letters behind your name you want. But if you've never replaced a roof or even made a repair to a roof system, I don't know how much credibility you have to tell everybody in this industry how to do it, right? Like, that's just the way I think about it. I know other attorneys will say, oh, no, if you have PE behind your name, then, you know, you should be able to determine how to replace a roof or repair a roof or when it should be repaired versus replaced. No, I think it's the person that's actually done it that matters to me. So yeah, I get it. It does matter in front of a jury. You're like, oh, here's a licensed engineer from Georgia Tech versus somebody who's replaced. But I think experience matters to me. That carries a lot of weight.
Yeah. But you know, engineers know everything. These are the smartest people on the planet. They have designed toilets that work in space. They are brilliant, witty. They get all the women. If an engineer has put it in writing, it has to be true.
Well, oh man, we can have this conversation all day. I think I'm in a really good spot to speak of this, you know, just because my company is so unique. But to touch your point on that and to close that one point about the getting on the phone, it's really important that our policyholder representatives also understand who they're talking to. You're never going to know, well, you should know, but you're not going to know somebody's authority. They're not going to tell you how much authority they have. Long time ago in my less than stellar people skill days, I remember getting on the phone with somebody. It was a six-figure claim. And I said, we've been on the phone for 45 minutes and we've been going round and round and round. I said, you still haven't given me a reason what's wrong with the estimate. I couldn't believe she had 45 minutes to talk to me because I sure as heck didn't. And I said, do you have enough authority to even approve this claim? And she said, well, you know, I can't tell you that. And I was an expert for this firm, and that's why I posed the question, because I knew. I said, would it be safe to say that you need to get a manager to give you permission to approve this. She said, I would have to get someone to help me with it. I said, okay, I can't buy a house with a 15-year-old. I'm going to need you to call your mom and dad and get them on the phone. I didn't say that now. I was negotiating with the wrong person. So the first thing that I do when I have a claim is I let them go through the motions. Look, the first thing I do when I send it for my construction company, you're going to have an estimate with ACV. Please, for the love of God, everybody listening to me. I was just in three trials and I couldn't believe two of them didn't have ACV value going into trial with a motion in limine on RCV. So we could only speak ACV. They were DOA for a directed verdict. And I found it in their transcript of all things. All these awesome experts out there, they're killing the cases in their transcript. So if you're going to be out there, do your ACV value. You must do that. Sworn proof of loss. Why are you not?
Let me ask you a real quick question on that. We're going to get back to where you're at. But the ACV is a big topic. I'm glad you brought it up like that. We've been saying the same thing for a long time. Yep. I think contractors need to be aware that they should be producing this kind of thing too. The problem is that it's defined differently in different states and among policies, and it's subjective as hell. So what kind of training does someone take to learn how to depreciate something?
Well, RCV is subjective too, right? So
that's true. That's true.
It's something that's argued. I mean, I've gone to appraisal on the ACV calculation multiple times on big claims. But I'll let John take this and run with it, 'cause I know it's pointed to him, but RCV is all, that's why you have appraisal kind of, right?
Yeah.
For a large portion of appraisals, right? So it's overpriced, but I'll let John take it from here.
Well, let's talk. You guys know I come about everything from a litigation standpoint because that's my forte. Nobody calls me just to hang out on the claims process, you know, unless they know it's going to be a problem. But who determines ACV value? Who determines it? There's an asshole. There's a black and white answer.
Well, there's a policyholder requirement in a lot of policies to come up with their valuation of the ACV as what it is that they're claiming on their proof of loss. Sure. But oftentimes, the carriers are the one that set that to begin with. Who's supposed to be doing it will depend on the policy.
So depending on the policy, especially in the state of Florida, it's actually the carriers are actually the people who do it. So if you want to make it easy on yourself, what we do is we do it based on age. It depends on the state you're in. Like if I work in New Mexico, there is no depreciation on residential properties. So you have to know the law as well. This is one big thing. Everybody thinks they're a lawyer. If you get on some of these forums, they all think they're lawyers. And so it depends on what state you're in. But let's just take Florida. The carrier does, unless otherwise stated. It says as determined by us. So you just take the percentage. If you know how to do the math, take it, divide it by the RCV, and there's your depreciation.
That language, as determined by us, is definitely not in every policy. It is in a few of them. In the state of Florida, the policies often do still require you to break down a proof of loss by ACV, RCV,
absolutely,
which would imply that the policyholder is required to present their own. And you can still have a discussion or disagreement on the amount of loss from an ACV perspective and have it be appraisable. So I think that we could argue, and every state is different. You're not wrong about that. I think we could argue that the carriers aren't necessarily the only ones that are required to determine what the ACV is. It is a negotiable item and oftentimes. But let me ask you this. If you're going to do it based on age, like you're saying, are you talking about each individual material?
There you go.
Based on age, or is it as a whole based on age, or how would you normally do it?
Okay, so this is exactly how we would do it. So you have to remember that we are an expert firm. So I'm in litigation most of the time. So I need to know everything that's going on. We're going to pull permit data. If I know there was a bathroom remodel, and let's say this is 2024, 2020, I'm going to depreciate the materials for 4 years on that bathroom. Now, the HVAC unit, if it's a 1952 house, you know, it's not from 1952. How old is it? Let's depreciate it, how old that is. So everything has a depreciable lifespan. So a toilet is 150 years, right? So
is that what it is for a toilet?
Yeah, it's 150 years. So if you look at a tile roof, you're going to find that they'll say 50 years. And I actually just came out of trial where the roof is from 1987. And it was actually still doing its job. Yeah. I mean, there was no wind damage to it. It's pretty impressive. So there, everything has a depreciable year. So that's why I like to do age. Now you can also do condition, all of that. But like you said, it's so subjective. Let's not muddy the water. Let's keep it straight like that. If the roof is only 15 years, depreciate it 15 years. Do your research. Ask them in an interview before you ever start, have you replaced any of the flooring since you moved in? Depreciate it on that. But that takes a little bit of extra work and not just putting a blanket over your estimate. And nobody thinks about it until we're in trial and they just hit a motion of limine for ACV value only and nobody calculated ACV value appropriately.
What if the toilet has taken a lot of shit over the years, though? Was it still a 150-year toilet?
It's doing its job, brother.
Hey, Matt Hunter, thank you for that chuckle. I appreciate it.
I think we both agree that ACV is mostly subjective. If you base it on the age and then it's based on the lifespan, you know, the lifespan of one toilet over another is going to be different from one toilet to the next. There are general life expectancies for generalized types of materials. Asphalt shingle roofs as a whole has an expected life expectancy that's written in places, but they don't have it broken down by design or architectural three tab, for example. They don't have it broken down by shingle manufacturer. And there are different warranty levels for a lot of these. It's not necessarily based on warranty, but all of these things are potential considerations when you're talking about a condition versus a lifespan expectancy versus how long it's been there. There is no real science on this. How would you teach someone to depreciate? And if it really is this subjective, why the hell is it so important? Right? So let's answer the why is it so important question. What is actually being litigated against? What did you mean by limiting so that a layman would understand what the hell you were saying?
Sure. So we have two cases that I absolutely hate in the state of Florida. Not much we can do about it. And that's Vasquez. And the other one is Salazar. So the Vasquez case, basically went in and says, you didn't do anything. We're sitting here in litigation. You're about to go in front of a jury. You haven't done a thing. You haven't spent your indemnity money for your ACV. You haven't repaired anything. And what does the policy say? We owe you for the actual cash value of the date of loss. So that's a big issue as well. People coming in with a 2024 estimate from Hurricane Sally. That's really going to get problematic. So what occurs is we owe you for the direct physical loss. So if only 1 square foot of drywall in a 500 square foot ceiling is damaged, we only owe you for 1 square foot of insulation, 1 square foot of drywall, 1 square foot of texture, 1 square foot of paint. We're not detaching or resetting anything on the walls. I just went through a trial on this. And this is the way the judges in the state of Florida are actually starting to, going with.
Are you giving me what the opposing counsel is saying to this person, or are you saying that that is true?
No, this is actually this is what's happening in the state
of
Florida.
This is the case. Okay.
Right. No, they're getting a motion in limine that you only speak on ACV value. And this is why I tell everyone, get a contractor involved. Spend the indemnity money. Show in good faith you're trying to make the repairs. Because what has happened in the past, and this was yesteryear, let's get our $30,000. Well, my PA says it's worth $300,000. So I'm not going to do anything with that $30,000. I'm just going to stick it in the bank and let it sit there. So you don't do anything. So now the house is just going to continue to do whatever it's doing. Maybe it's going to get, they're going to start saying they're prejudiced because you neglected to mitigate damages or, you know, tarp your roof 850 times, those types of things. And that's the whole purpose of it. It's so you don't just go, hey, Mr. Attorney, take my case, sue them, get me all of my RCV, and then I'll make the repairs. That's not how it works. It's not how it works at all. And now we're getting motion to limine, so all we can speak is ACV value when people just squat on it. The days of grabbing a claim, giving it to an attorney, and saying, here you go, Mr. Attorney, be my bank to hire an expert and solve my case, those days are over.
Well, I mean, in Florida, it's definitely changed. It'll be more like the other states, mostly correct, because you're not going to get the automatic fee shift for the attorneys. But people like Remington that work in other states are still going to be just as successful. Absolutely. In the state of Florida going forward. And people still have the ability to sue their insurance company. It's just not a guarantee anymore that you're going to come out the other end and still be able to make repairs and things. So there is some differences there. But Just to go back on that, just to make sure that the audience is aware, I don't know which what case were you talking about with the direct physical loss portion of that?
Well, yeah, Vasquez and Salazar both speak both about that.
Okay. So
speak on it. Now, I'm not an attorney. Remington is. He can speak on it better than I can. He can clear all that
up. Well, Remington can correct me if I'm wrong here. I know he's not going to, though, because I'm right. But direct physical loss would include the RCV value of that 1 square foot of drywall, which would include everything necessary to actually replace that, which would include all the stuff that has to be replaced along with it, not just that 1 square foot. So I know there are a lot of carriers that will say, well, we don't owe for that. We only owe for direct physical loss. And they just don't understand what that really means either, because they've maybe had a meeting where they were told all these things about their policy, and just so they didn't have to get it defined on the inside. This is my skeptic on the inside talking to me, by the way. They're told as they're leaving the room, all right, adjusters, don't forget, we only offer direct physical loss. And they're not really told what the hell that means. But there's plenty of case law that talks about that. It includes everything that it takes to make a proper repair. And if anything that is damaged along the way that is unavoidable happens to get damaged, then it includes the replacement of those things as well. So if you cannot tie in the 1 square foot of drywall, 1 square foot of insulation, all that to the existing drywall in a way that brings it back to a pre-loss condition, then the direct physical loss would include everything else that has to be replaced along with it. So I just want the audience to be aware of that. And apparently the carriers are still trying to make that argument, which is crazy to me, because there's lots of documentation on this in the court systems. It's so weird.
But I don't know if I would put it on. Well, obviously, we're going to take sides here if that's what we're going to do, which we're not. I'm not, because that's not what I do. But okay, you have to remember, I've written reports for motions for summary judgment on the definitions of surface water that were given by Duval County. Then if you go down to somewhere in Lee County, I think it was, somebody, another judge made a statement about surface water and gave a completely different definition. So it also is going to depend on the judge. Does the judge believe that case law, you know, at the same time? So it's very wonky. Once we get into litigation, what works in claims, this is what I think I'm trying to say that may not be conveyed very well. What works in claims doesn't always translate well to litigation. And since I work litigation, that's where my focus is. That's the first thing I look for, is where are all the little pinholes that are going to sink the ship?
All right. I don't think we actually disagree with each other anyway on this particular issue, but I definitely get your point. The there is a difference between litigation and working things as a public adjuster. It's actually a good point. I have conversations about this with Remington all the time. Remington, how many times have we talked about how public adjusters don't really need to go to an attorney and ask how to do their jobs? Why would an attorney know how to be a public adjuster? They know how to litigate, and it's a very different thing, right?
So absolutely, and that's something where, I mean, you know this. I've made this comment multiple times. I'm not a public adjuster. I'm not going to necessarily say you have to do X, Y, Z. Like, I'm not a licensed public adjuster, and I expect the same. Like, hey, why are you telling an attorney like how to do their job? Why are you trying to tell a contractor how to do their job if you're not actually in that profession to some extent, right? And I say that by, like, I have a good idea of what a good public adjuster does because I've seen thousands of files from public adjusters, but I'm not going to act like I am one. That's just one thing. And also, I do agree with John about the different districts in Florida. It is, because I'm licensed in Florida, been licensed for almost a decade. It's almost like going to a different state, some of these districts, like he's talking about Dade versus, you know, going over to Lee. So I do want to piggyback off of that.
The policy can dictate what direct physical loss really means fairly easily, because when you go into the section that says how we pay for a covered loss, it says that they will pay the amount that's reasonably necessary to repair or replace a damaged property. And that's obviously going to include anything that is reasonably necessary to actually replace and repair the property, which would involve all the things that occur that are unavoidable as part of the normal course of construction. Now, if you suck at your job, there might be some liability concerns there. But outside of that, if you're estimating the 1 square foot of drywall work, you're going to estimate in all the stuff that's necessary to do that, which would be more than 1 square foot. Well, maybe it wouldn't. It depends on the width of the studs, all that fun stuff. So there's just a difference there. And I just wanted to make sure the audience was clear that that was the argument that the the council was making, and not necessarily the opinion of John Pruitt.
Well, no, well, let's take it one step further, just a touch. What some of those cases are talking about is, let's say that you have popcorn ceilings. We're going to cut out the drywall. Oh, yeah, you got to get it to the studs. I get that. The bottom quarter of the truss, you know, just screw it in if it's on the ceiling. We're talking about the popcorn, though, because now we're going into RCV, because now we're talking about just taking everything, you know, matching the popcorn. If we're talking about the siding and we just have the lap siding, we're not replacing the sheathing. Of course, let's let the house wrap argument and there's holes in the, you know, all that.
Yeah, kind of won't go there right now.
Let's get the semantics out of it. But, you know, to say that we owe you for the entire wall. When I say we, by the way, I don't work for insurance companies. I only work through attorneys. So I don't mean we. But to say that the one side owes you for an entire wall for ACV value when one board was cracked, that's where I am seeing the rulings come in. That's where I'm saying, no. ACV, you've only got one board to damage. We're only going to pay you for one board. But the funny thing is, you hear how much we're debating, if you will, a little bit here. This is all over the country is going to be different. And that's where so much, when you get these armchair quarterbacks saying, no, this is definitive. Okay, well, you're in New Jersey, dude. You get what I'm saying? Because kind of the policy language you just said, I know for a fact, in the three of the trials I was in, it literally says, we owe for the direct actual cash value of the direct physical loss of the date of loss, right? You know, so there's different there at the time of loss, yeah. Excuse me,
but so there is different loss. It's weird. Language isn't typically defined, and so it ends up being defined by the courts, and there is case law at federal level in well, it's all persuasive, and we're not actually having a debate on this. I think that we're both on the same page there. It all starts with what has been damaged and then what it takes to actually replace that damage and bring it back to a pre-loss condition a lot of times. The actual cash value portion of that, I want to bring us back to that at the time of loss language. This is interesting language that has been debated recently in Florida. I love Chip Merlin has a very fun idea about how that ought to be applied, and I kind of want to bring it up. I don't necessarily agree with this opinion, but it's really kind of funny. But at the time of loss has generally been applied as if you're using the Xactimate from the month of the loss kind of a thing. That's how it's been applied, but no. Oh, you have a different opinion on that?
Well, you were there, Fapia, when I spoke on ACV, RCV, right? So sure. What does Xactimate's language say in their terms and conditions? Their price list is historical. Historical. So that means if Hurricane Sally hit September 16, 2020, you don't use September because now you're charging the August pricing. You should be charging the September pricing, which is actually in October, because it's historical pricing. Does that make sense?
So you think that at the time of loss should be 1 month ahead?
I think it should be behind it. I think if a hurricane hits in September, I think you should use October because the pricing's historical. How do you capture September pricing?
Is further down the line. Yeah, we're saying the same thing, just using the backwards timeline. All right, so that's interesting.
That's my opinion.
Yeah. You want to hear Merlin's take on it?
Sure.
At the time of loss, what does at the time mean?
As the hurricane is coming over. During the loss, I guess it would be.
During the loss. How much would it cost to get all the materials and a crew there ready to go while the loss is occurring?
Well, first off, you've got a curfew and you've got a lot of other problems. So it'd be very, very expensive.
So you'd be paying off police and shit too then, I guess. So it would be even more expensive.
I love the argument because it creates the ambiguity that as the unsophisticated party you would want.
I love
the argument.
Yeah, that's great. You know, there's time frame issues that are ambiguous and said to be ambiguous throughout the policy. The term immediate doesn't really have any meaning. The term prompt has been fought in all states, or it seems like it's being fought in all states for prompt notice kind of language. It depends on what's in that policy, but you know, immediate really truly has no meaning. If it has to be immediate, then it'd have to be during the loss. If immediate meant immediately, like at that moment. So if it doesn't have to be during the loss, if it's the next day and they still accept that as immediate, then a time amount can expire in between. Well, how much time can expire in between before it's no longer immediate? And it just, that's where the ambiguity lies. So all those time frame things, they definitely change the language. But at the time of loss, I like what you're saying about the Xactimate though. Being historical, that's I don't remember that from your thing. So you were sleeping. Either wasn't paying attention or I didn't actually make it to that, to your full class. It's probably that I didn't make it to the full class.
Yeah, it's okay. I talk for a living, so that's okay. You'll hear me a lot more. But it's an interesting it's a good point. But you know, if you think about it, in my world, everything I say is going to be used against me at a later date. Now, whatever I say here, this will pop up at a trial in 10 years, and they'll be like, "Look, when you said this," and I'll be like, "Yep," and I still believe it. You know, that happens all the time.
That doesn't always happen. I was in trial recently. I was on the stand for 5 minutes. Even during the trial deposition that they gave me and stuff, it'd be so easy to Google search my name and have a list of shit that they could do against me. Nothing came up.
Nothing. Well, that's because I'll be honest with you. This happened to me in a trial and I was whipping this dude and I was for the carrier and it was on an AOB shrink wrap case. And I'll give you the short end of it. And this is in the panhandle of Florida. So this is really important. If you're going to, since I'm considered this expert or whatever, I'll give you some insight as what it's like to be an expert for anybody listening. Nobody likes a bully. Nobody likes a bully. This is why I'm trying to tell everybody in the claims handling process, be nice. What does it hurt you? It hurts you to be a jerk. So this guy comes up to the panhandle of Florida on a shrink wrap case. The carrier gave him permission on a right to repair, by the way. We'll give you $2.50 a foot to put a regular blue tarp on. Well, their client had dementia. By the way, the roofer shows up to do the roof. And they say, no, we need an engineer. This roof is barely touched. So the roofer leaves. $18,000 was the price for him to do the roof. They got permission for the blue tarp at $6,250. And then they shrink wrapped it for $18,500 after all that went down. And their client had dementia. That's the kind of garbage that we see. The attorney comes up and it's a shrink wrap case. And he's asking all these questions and he can't beat me on technical. So what did they do? If you're talking about trial, how they can bring stuff up, he starts to attack my integrity. Okay, well, that's not going to go over well. Guy's in a 3-piece suit from Miami coming up from Brickell, and he just starts beating on me. Like, oh, yes, sir, that happened. Oh, absolutely, sir. And now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what he's conveniently leaving out is that I did X, Y, and Z. And it's an honor to sit here and being able to testify in front of you. No further questions. And he sits down, and they lost the case. On an AOB shrink wrap case, totally lost it. And he never deposed me. He never did anything, but he wanted to be a jerk. And because he was a jerk, I was watching the jury lose him completely, just looking at him like he was just the devil. So that's why I don't want to do it. You only use
it at my trial. You nailed exactly what it ended up coming down to. So, and he lost the jury immediately and everything. Right after that 5 minutes, they adjourned for an extra long lunch. There was a whole bunch of crap and it was resolved before we even came back in. So just like I tell every woman on the planet, 5 minutes with me is more than enough.
Sounds too long, but whatever.
Hey, we've been on this ACV discussion a little bit. So I want to throw this out here. This is my view on it because I know different districts in Florida have different views on it. Different states have different views on it. If the carrier is, let's just say it's 10 tiles. If they're paying the ACV of just 10 tiles, I think it's unconscionable for a court to say that the homeowner had to replace the entire roof for them to get those RCV benefits versus if the carrier was actually giving ACV for the entire roof, but the homeowner sat on that. To me, there's huge, vastly different situation. Because what is the carrier doing? They're saying you have to comply with these terms of the policy. You have to spend this money to get this depreciation. But the scope is wildly different. So you're asking a homeowner to take out a loan and pay for a roof and to roll the dice at trial to win to be able to get RCV benefits. Why in the world would a carrier not just deny everything or do a repair versus a replacement and make all these homeowners or all of these policyholders come out of pocket to get RCV? To me, it's like more of a just public policy argument. That's where it gets me. I get it if they gave you ACV for the entire roof and you sat on it for 2 years. I get that. But if you're paying for 10 tiles on a 70 or what's called a 50 square roof, and you expect them to come out of pocket six figures, that to me, that's not right. And also, if a court's going to enforce the terms of a policy, this is what the ruling should be at the end. If you agree it should be a full roof versus 10 tiles, then the court should say this: we're going to give you ACV for the entire roof, and you have 180 days to repair it or replace it. And if you do, then the carrier has to give you depreciation versus just saying you're only due ACV. That's my soapbox on it. That's how I feel about it.
Oddly enough, since we had Badger's face on the screen a little bit earlier, were you about to say the same thing, John?
I don't know.
Badger just posted an endorsement that his company sent out to some different carriers that basically turned policies into reimbursement policies that they would get zero ACV funds for a roof claim if the roof is a certain age or something along those lines, or whatever kind of caveat would be there. Once it hits this payment schedule, there would be no ACV payment. It wouldn't be a bifurcated system. It would strictly be a full RCV payment only after they're able to prove that they actually spent the money to do so. So all of what Remington just said becomes impossible for someone. And the reality is, of course, that would be taken advantage of. The psychologists that work at these companies would easily be able to say, well, most people aren't going to be able to do that, so they're going to avoid filing claims. Or they'll just walk away because they can't make the next step necessary to gain their benefits. So anyway, that's my two cents on something that I haven't dug that much into, but that was posted today. So just happened to be the same thing you was talking about.
Well, let me ask you this. A lot of things you're discussing, and Remington, you're spot on some of that. And I actually agree with you in many cases as a contractor. So after a state of emergency, a lot of times, this is the bad part about all of it. If you don't know what strings to pull, you don't know what to do. So after a state of emergency, a lot of times Small Business Administration will give out 2% loans, right? But you got to know that to actually go pull the trigger on that. The other side of that too is, I don't know, but you know, talk to the lawyers. I'm not a lawyer. I don't even play one on TV. If they give you 10 tiles, you replace the 10 tiles and you show that it's not matching. And now you fulfilled your, you know, you fulfilled the fact that, look, it doesn't match anymore. Now I want to come back for my ACV. I mean, you've done the indemnity. So I think that there's things that we can do, but if we don't educate, if our training doesn't change from people get licensed to you need to advise your people to do X, Y, and Z when they get indemnified, don't just tell them to sit on the money, because that's just subjective of, this is my opinion, you should just sit on the money. At least exhaust the money of the ACV that you've been given to show you've given a good faith effort and that you just don't have the funds. But if you just squat on it, they're going to scream prejudice and neglect and all these of neglect and all these other different things. So it's really important. It's really important that we don't just squat on the money and show that we tried, we did our best. And I do agree with you, Remington, but I think that's a legislation area. I was very, very open. I said I would go testify when Florida went through their little bull crap they went through, to be honest. I said to multiple state and senator, House of Reps and senators, they have put a Band-Aid on cancer. And sure enough, I got a call 2 weeks after they passed that stupid bill from somebody on the insurance commission saying they wanted to talk to me about my thoughts. Sure enough. We might see the pendulum swing back a little bit later on, but we'll have to wait to see.
That's the way it always works.
We'll have to wait to see.
Yeah, sometimes that pendulum doesn't come back for decades.
Everything's cyclical.
Such as Georgia.
Georgia's tough. Year on hail, and there's not a lot of favorable things for the policyholder in Georgia. Georgia's not a fun state, I will say that.
Yep. It's not fun. Remington and I both know. Anyway, we're not really here to talk about Georgia. So let's try to wrap back up into our topic. I've got a few questions from the audience I want to pull in. I guess this isn't our, what happens when the carrier, this is from Robert Sanchez, for those listening on podcast, what happens when the carrier over depreciates the roof, for example, without even knowing the history of replacement on the roof system?
Real easy. Pull the permit data and prove it. You should have already proved it. You should never have submitted something without being able to prove your case. Put a left nine in the note in there. It says, here's the building permit is attached. 2010, it's 2018, it's 8 years old, I've depreciated based on X. Without the information, you're asking a desk adjuster who is 18 years old and just got off pimple cream, who took a 40-hour course for maritime, farmland, liability, workman's comp, property, and now this guy's an expert? You got to hold his hand. Tell him. That's why you got to get on the phone with these guys and talk to the claims director. Stop talking to the desk adjusters.
That's true.
I like that. And also, you know, good bit of the times this is inaccurate, but they ask you in the underwriting file how old your roof is before they insure that risk. So that's something they can reflect on. But look, the permit's the way to go. I agree with John.
Yeah. Good advice. And honestly, you should go back to what John had said a little bit earlier, to just do the ACV, change that kind of thing, go through the motions of what the carrier is asking you to do, spend the ACV money, show that you've exhausted it. But this is good advice across the entire gambit. You know, if they put the ball in your court and they're asking you to do something and you don't do it, who does that come back to? It's not necessarily on them anymore. So you can't be the reason for the delays, right?
You better play ball. And I'm telling you, like, people follow me around where they used to. Since I work both sides of the fence now, it doesn't happen very often because usually I'm retained by the other side I'm coming for. So they're like, don't worry about it. They used to follow me around with a camera. I don't give a crap. Follow me around with a camera. Doesn't matter to me. In fact, here's a piece of chalk. Go mark up everything that I missed. You know what I mean? It's like just play. Everybody plays ball and then we find a way. But when you tell somebody, like my engineers, if you're going to tell my engineers that they're dumb as a box of rocks, well, I'm sorry, the smart guy is going to win every day of the week. They are. They're going to. Because the carrier is going to make a decision based on what they say. So you better play nice.
They are going to make that decision, regardless of whether or not that engineer is dumb as a box of rocks or not. A lot of times they're going to side with the expert that they hired. How could they not?
They have to. They have to. Let's be honest. Yep. You know, I mean, if it's egregious, that's a different world. That guy should lose his license. I fully believe that.
I mean, that comes down to whether or not that expert should have taken that assignment on or not. And that's an issue with the licensing board and that engineer, not necessarily the carrier. Unless the carrier was explicit and knew that up front, the engineer told them that they weren't competent for that kind of a project. And then they were told to go do it anyway. But that's
actually how we killed what you're talking about right now. This is how we stay out of what's called Daubert. So for you that don't know what Daubert is, it's basically a case from, you know, long time ago that basically says you have to rely on eyewitness testimony, scientific methodology, and a few other things. And that's why what works in claims doesn't work in litigation, because we actually have to prove it by the standards of Fry or Daubert. So when our firm writes an engineering report, we have a PhD meteorologist tells the weather, whether it's flood versus wind or it's hail or whatever. I've already got a PhD meteorologist doing it. Then the engineer talks physics, and then me or one of my other building consultants, we sign the same engineering report for roofing or construction repairability. That way when we're in depositions, we go talk to the other guy. That's his wheelhouse. And we all sign the same report. That's to eliminate anyone calling us frauds, and we stay in our lane. That's our business model.
I think that's a good way to go about it. It's what we teach you to discuss with the engineer in the Defeating Unethical Engineers tactics class at the Building Experts Institute is really just have a conversation with that engineer, find out what their assignment is, and make sure that all parts of that assignment are something that they are competent to do so. And if there's something that's going to require a meteorologist degree or certification or something along those lines, I would have a conversation with that engineer in advance. Listen, maybe we should get a meteorologist involved, Mr. Engineer. I don't want you to end up getting in trouble by taking on something that's outside your competence. This might go down to what the meteorologist would say anyway. So I'll go back to the carrier and I'll see if they're willing to hire a meteorologist so you don't have to go down that path. And I'll kind of take it as if I'm taking, you know, I got their back. I'm not trying to get them in trouble for anything. I'm not trying to give them enough rope to hang themselves with. We're just trying to resolve this case or this claim. We don't have to play the games. Whatever the rules are, as long as we're all abiding by it, you can help the other person actually abide by those rules without being a dick.
That's right.
Mike Abernathy says that John Pruitt is the man. And he would only say that if he thought that you were more of a man than myself or Remington. in order for this to show up on the screen right now. So
I'm less of a man. I have lost all my hair because I've been dealing with all of you for so long. I used to have hair. I got this industry. I had hair. Now I don't have any hair.
So he says, what's your opinion on paid when incurred, doing the work and proving the invoice?
Actually, we just talked work, about this. I'm going to be really, well, if the question is going where I think it's going to go, a couple years ago, we had a case where a contractor got in trouble for submitting estimates and an appraisal when the work was done for about half. All right. I'm not making a statement about that, who the contractor was, none of that. But we got case law because of that. And if it's cost incurred, guys, I don't know what to tell you. If it costs you $10,000 for your roof, you're not hiding the PA fee in it, man. I mean, you're going to give up that copy of that check in litigation. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, there's the whole house has to be done or whatever, but unfortunately, with the way that world is turning, and we've had so many storms that the courts are really making it hard to get full indemnity in litigation. So my view is it's case by case standard, but if you struck a check for a new kitchen for 60 grand and you're going after 100 grand, the courts in Florida, at least, and I believe in Texas and some other ones, have basically said that's fraud. That's not John Pruitt calling it fraud, but I know for a fact the judge wrote in his opinion on the one that I'm talking about, which I'm not going to name, that it was the most egregious set of fraud in property he's dealt with. So take it for what it is.
That's from sending in an invoice after they did the work for that, or sending in an estimate?
Actually, in this case, they went to appraisal and they submitted their Xactimate estimate when it was an AOB and they had already paid out everybody. Because let's not forget, you use some contractors. Who do you think is going to get those invoices? And I hate it, guys. I mean, I understand we want to try to cover the PA fees, want to try to cover the deductible, all these different things. But the courts have made it very clear what cost incurred means. It's not John Pruitt saying this. It's what I've dealt with.
It would make more sense, instead of attacking the PA fee issue going into stuff, it would make more sense that if the PA gets involved and is able to convince the carrier that they have underpaid by a certain percentage, that the PA fees would be covered as a separate charge by the carriers for the policyholder having to hire one in order to gain the benefits of their policy properly. And that way they can stop worrying about whether or not someone's hiding the PA fees in there or not, and they can still benefit their policyholders, which would give them more credibility in making the argument that if their whole reason behind a lot of this language is to prevent contractors from hiding PA fees, prevent policyholders from hiding PA fees, then give us the PA fees separately if we can prove that it was necessary to hire one.
Okay.
John, you would love this, John. We were at the Capitol in Atlanta, and Matt specifically asked this question to the DOI. And they answered, well, if it's an incurred cost, I could see, you know, if it was necessary, I could see why, yeah, the contractor could cover that fee. It was something to that effect. And correct me if I'm wrong, yeah. Matt, but it was
the commissioner while we were negotiating the language in House Bill 254, which I was the president of GAPI at the time. So I was sitting across from the table. We're going line by line through the thing. We were directly negotiating. And we asked the guy, when we got to a portion of 254 that said that a public adjuster cannot receive any form of remuneration from a contractor. And we asked him, well, what if the contractor is covering the public adjuster's costs on behalf of the policyholder? It's still being charged to the policyholder, but the contractor has agreed out of the goodness of their hearts to cover that cost so that the policyholder only has to pay their deductible out of pocket. Would that be a conflict of interest? And the language went on to say, or any other remuneration that would be reasonably perceived as a conflict of interest. That was the language. And the attorney to the commissioner said it wouldn't be a conflict of interest if the public adjuster wasn't charging any more than their customary fees. And we did say to them that if the policyholder didn't use that contractor, the policyholder would still be required to pay the PA's fees. It's almost as if the policyholder has set up a GoFundMe account somewhere and accepted donations to help them pay the PA's fees. And then the contractor was being nice and paid the entire GoFundMe account. Is there anything wrong with that?
I'm going to be really honest with you guys. I'm actually a proponent for PA's fees to be covered in certain situations.
Right.
However, caveat, if you bring me an estimate for hail damage and it's $300,000 for a roof, because here's your argument. I love this argument. Well, all the decking didn't have all those nails from the roof that's being removed. So now we've got to replace the deck. Okay. Well, I guess, well, that decking was installed into those trusses, and those trusses didn't have the nails from the decking. Yeah, now we got to replace the trusses. Yeah. Now we got to replace the insulation because we got to remove the trusses, which the drywall is attached to. But the HVAC ductwork and the electrical runs through the trusses. So we got to remove those. Let's just tear the house down because it's a hail damage. That's what we've got to stop. And honestly, I believe you should lose your license if you are that PA. I had a guy call me the other day. Hey, I got a cracked truss. If we got a cracked truss, I can get the entire roof and the trusses. I said, not for me, you can't.
That's ridiculous. The entire roof, not just that one truss?
Right, because it's light. People are like, oh, it's not like kind quality. Like, all right, you want to get into this? That truss can have a repair truss made. That's not like kind quality? No, but the load-bearing capacity is. What are we trying to get here? Aesthetics? All right, well, let's just have the carriers continue on their cosmetic exclusions. All right, let's just make up another reason to get you guys to not have money because we're going stupid with everything. So what's more important, the way it looks in the attic that you'll never see or the load-bearing capacity of that truss being repaired?
Well, this is the mentality we got to fix. What like kind of quality really means. And to be completely frank with you, John, those PAs that are doing that, and I teach this in my class, and we actually agree. So let me give you that caveat real quick before I keep going and make it sound like I disagree with you. We actually agree on this. You can take a policy, you can take building code, and you could literally say everything that you just said, that it would end up gutting and end up replacing, and even all the way down to the foundation being replaced for one damaged shingle. You could literally do that, and you would technically be right. But what the policy does say is reasonably necessary. And so there is such a thing as a reasonable repair. It's never going to be 100% the same as new construction because it's not the same motions as new construction. There's always going to be a nail hole left behind that wasn't there before. Now, if you were to take that whole nail hole in the decking argument and go further with it and prove that the pull resistance of the current nails in that decking isn't up to snuff, which I know for a fact is true, give you an interesting scenario. When I was teaching at NCI, we had these boards that we would put shingles on, and during the asphalt shingle roof inspection course, it was a 5-day course. One of the days was a portion of one of the days was about repairability. So we had the contractors and the PAs and the attorneys that came into that class. We would actually hand them tools. We'd show them how to do simulated repair. We remove a shingle, put the same shingle back in. And we would do that over and over again. We had one board that had architectural shingles, one board that had three tabs. And it didn't necessarily always stay that way. But one of the roof decks was OSB, and one of them was plywood, half-inch CDX plywood. By the fifth roof on those, or the fifth time I did that class, I could pull the nails out of the OSB by hand.
That's right.
But I couldn't do that with the plywood still.
So you've heard me say this before. There's actually a mathematical formula for this. And I love when everybody says, oh, these stupid engineers, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. I have one guy, I remember him saying, I've got my own science. I'm like, oh, good God, please don't do this, man. Dude, because some of my engineers are some of the smartest people I've ever met. I mean, it kills me to sit in their meetings. But, you know, they say the H in engineer is for happiness. And, you know, these guys are really, really smart. But there's all these formulas for everything that everybody argues. The math doesn't lie. It doesn't lie. I'll be honest with you. You got an OSB roof. After the fourth roof, on your fifth roof, you got to replace the deck.
There's probably a number in there between the second roof and the fifth roof where it became so weak that the wind resistance wouldn't be there anymore. But you'd have to do actual scientific testing to find that out. You can't just make that statement. There's no specific research on this. So there might even, if we were to graph a pull test after doing it over and over again, we might be able to determine based on these conditions that there is a linear progression, or maybe it's exponential. Who knows? But there hasn't been anything on there. So we haven't done that yet. I haven't done the testing yet. Some of the attempts at the testing have been interesting, but you'd have to prove it. That's all it comes down to.
Well, I'll make it really easy for everybody here. If you want to know the truth, who determines whether or not a roof deck gets replaced in the building code? The roofer.
Building official?
The roofer.
The roofer.
The roofer takes responsibility. The guy, exactly. The guy who says, whoa, whoa, this deck isn't going to hold it. So in Florida a few years back, we changed our nail patterns, right? We went to peel and seal, or you could do, you know, 50% staggered. You nail it 6 inches on the perimeter, 12 inches staggered in the field. All right, so we're going to add a
ton. Well, it's 8 now in Florida in the field.
So we're going to take, not the deck. I'm just talking about the underlayment. So we have 4 rows of simplex nails. Then we have 6 nails per shingle. Okay. The rest of the states are 4. So all these nails are being added, right? The roofer is the one who stands on it and feels that thing crunch. The roofer is the one who has to say, I can't install these shingles because I can't guarantee that I'm going to be able to make this happen. Everybody's upset at the engineer. It's not the engineer's decision. In fact, before we got into forensics, one of my structural engineers was with me today. I said, hey, man, I need you to check out this roof to let me know if I need to replace the deck. He goes, no, you make that decision. Okay. And we did. We replaced the deck. And the building official's like, okay. You just got to use your common sense, man.
That's a good point. But ultimately, it comes down to that. There is a reasonable repair that can be made.
Yes.
You don't have to get everything back to a 100% pre-loss condition. It's not fair to the insurance company. I'll say it that way. I'm sure someone will take a snippet of me saying that suddenly.
Again, I'm glad they did, Matt, because yeah. I'm going to be honest with you. You know, as a leader in this industry, if you're going to portray yourself in the public sector, so if I'm out there, I've said this a bunch of times, and I know we're probably getting close to wrapping up, so I'll just say it. Yeah. I have been very, very clear. You want to make progress. You don't get on the internet and say the carriers suck. You don't get on the internet and say public adjusters are really bad people. I had a guy the other day who's a carrier, right to repair guy. He says all these restoration contractors are just profiting on the unfortunate policyholders. And I responded with, don't you do right to repair? Don't you make your money on the unfortunate, you know, circumstances of the policyholder? This isn't how we find middle ground. We find middle ground by getting together and getting into a room. And I'll be the first one to be there. And Matt, I love the fact that you said that, because you being on the circuit, acting as a leader in the industry, needs to have that kind of conversation. And when somebody says the carriers are horrible people, you need to be able to say, well, maybe you should go talk to someone like John Pruitt, or go talk to someone who's been successful with the carriers, has never sued them, and actually gets their stuff done. Now, I'm not saying that none of my clients haven't gone and sued on their own, but John Pruitt, as an AOB who had full control, never sued anybody. So I appreciate you being a leader in the industry. And I know we're all going to have disagreements on both sides, because I think both sides have problems, but I'll be the first one to be in a room with any legislator who wants to get in and actually talk about these issues.
I mean, the reality is that we're talking about a word like reasonable, and that's going to be subjective, and it's going to be different from all parties involved and based on their motivations and what it is that they need and their agendas. So a reasonable repair to one person is going to be different from a reasonable repair to somebody else. And so if we're going to be fighting over that very ambiguous language in a policy, which is what most of our arguments really come down to, then it's going to take a reasonable conversation. And that's how you gain respect.
That's how you gain respect. And I'm going to tell you right now, if you guys want to keep, not you guys, but the policyholder side wants to keep taking on the 800-pound gorilla.
You are pretty heavy.
You guys better come with your own 800-pound gorilla, because it hasn't worked out for us so far. So let's find a reasonable way to work with the other side. Let's start it by not saying they're a bunch of crooks.
Yeah.
That's how we start it. Even if you don't believe it, that's how we start it.
I mean, you have to, this is what I teach. If you're going to have any kind of a negotiation with someone or an argument with the carrier, or they do something egregious, you're biased as hell. You're going to assume that they're doing it on purpose. If you go at that with the assumption that they did that on purpose, even if you're trying to play nice, it's going to come across as ingenuine. If instead you forced yourself to assume that it was an honest mistake, even if you know better, you just assume it was an honest mistake and take that approach. Explain what it is that the problem was. Assume it was an honest mistake. Let them correct the issue. I guarantee you're going to get a lot more wins under the belt. Things are going to go your way, and you're going to have a better relationship with that other party going forward. Especially 300%. If it turns out you ended up saving their career out of nowhere, and they didn't even realize they did something stupid. So just play nice. Don't be a dick.
That's it.
Yeah. All right. Let me go over our sponsors real quick, which I was supposed to do in the middle of the show, and I failed to do so again. God, I suck at my job. Claim Titan. If you are a public adjuster, an appraiser, or a supplement company, this is a CRM that is designed just for you. Eric at Claim Titan has been putting in a ton of work to develop all the sides necessary for the supplement companies and the appraisal companies lately, since so many of you are turning to appraisal as your primary source of work. And then he's going to actually turn over and start working towards having expert work as one of the primary types of individuals that would use this software. So if you're looking for a CRM that does everything that you need to and a lot of good APIs to tie in a lot of stuff, Claim Titan is amazing. It's really good. Building Experts Institute is a company that I'm involved in. It is a online go at your own pace school for right now insurance claim work and building consultant type work. We've got 8 different courses on there that are 4 to 8 hours long, very in-depth, very beautiful, like a masterclass. We're about to wrap up the first asphalt shingle roof inspection certification courses that'll be there. The next class to drop will be repairability of asphalt shingles, which will have Chad Williams, the guy that wrote the National Academy of Forensic Engineers assessment guide for assessing the repairability of asphalt shingles, and John Senek, who's actually going to be performing all of the work on this. Hook Agency, if you're a roofing company, is a marketing firm that is so freaking good at their job, they even convinced somebody, me, to get a tattoo at a roofing convention, and I'm terrified of needles. I wasn't crying in that video. The American Policyholder Association is a group of individuals that is looking to uncover insurance fraud committed by insurance carriers. They are protecting policyholders from such things. I believe it is something that happens. It happens often even. Proving that is a difficult endeavor because you're talking about accusing someone of fraud. But if you have anything like that going on, go to apassociation.org and submit your file. Let them take a look at it. They've got retired FBI investigators handling the investigation, a lot of these things. Huggins Law Firm, that's Remington. He's the owner right there. Probably the best attorney firm that I've ever worked, definitely the best attorney firm I've ever worked with. But you guys are in definitely Georgia, Florida, and what other states are we working with now?
Right now, I'm in federal court in 6 different states right now. But Southeast is our concentration for sure. So
about that Southeast. I feel like you need to change the name from Huggins Law Firm to Huggins Law Southeast.
There you go.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be hiring John as an expert in cases going forward. How about that, guys? So we're going to
That's not a bad idea.
There you go. There you go.
All right. So if someone wanted to hire you though, John, what where do they go?
You can go to addisonriley.com or you can call 850-776-5009. The only thing I say is if you call us, you better expect the truth and don't ask us to sway, because if you do, we won't work with you. Other than that, we're retained by everybody and against everyone at the exact same time because the report's the same.
There you go. We could have just ended the podcast early if you'd have just said that from the beginning. That's how you gain the respect of the insurance carriers. You tell them that you're going to be honest and truthful either way. So unless they're shady as hell, which I'm sure there are some, then they're going to really appreciate that. I know that I would from our side. Unless our side is shady as hell, they're going to appreciate that too. And I'm sure there are some. So there's bullshit on both sides. All right. Well, thanks for watching, everybody. We'll be back on next Tuesday at 4 p.m. I think we have Hare Shenovar on, the attorney. We're talking about the Level Up conference that's coming up. So check things out on next Tuesday at 4 p.m. We will see you then. In the meantime, keep dealing with that bull.